Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our mission here is to take complex intellectual terrain, you know, the kind of material that really shapes philosophical research, and map it out so you can get straight to the essential mind-bending insights.
Today, we are deep diving into a crucial area of contemporary philosophy known as conceptual ethics. Specifically, we're unpacking the framework laid out in the book, The Ethics of Conceptualization, tailoring thought and language to needs.
And this is really a must-read for anyone in meta-ethics, philosophy of language, or political philosophy.
It really is. So conceptual ethics, as thinkers like Burgess and Plunkett define it, is all about the normative question.
The evaluative questions.
Exactly. The questions about the very concepts, the words, the representational tools we use in our thought and talk. We're not just analyzing how we use our language.
We're asking if the tools themselves are any good. Are they fit for purpose?
Precisely. And that gets right to the heart of the book's thesis. Our goal in this deep dive is to guide you through its central argument, which reframes the entire field around a single, powerful organizing idea, the concept of conceptual authority.
Okay, let's unpack this right away, because this isn't just some minor academic distinction. It feels like a fundamental reorientation of the whole project.
It is. Historically, you have a giant like Kant asking, you know, how concepts bind us? How do they become liable to an assessment of correctness when we apply them?
Right. So does this particular action count as just? Am I using the concept correctly?
That's the first order problem. But this book tackles a completely distinct second order challenge, which is why these concepts rather than others should be allowed to bind us in the first place.
Wow. So it's not about whether I applied the concept of, say, blasphemy correctly.
No.
It's about whether I should have been using the concept of blasphemy at all.
Yeah, that's the pivot. We're asking for the reasons to cast our thoughts in certain terms. Reasons to adopt or maybe maintain or even discard certain conceptual frameworks. Why should I agree to play the game by these rules?
And for our audience, for the philosophy students and researchers listening, why are the stakes so incredibly high here? Why not just stick to the first order disagreements?
Because focusing on conceptual authority directly addresses what you might call the core problem of philosophical confinement.
Confinement.
Thinkers, especially in academic fields, get locked into specific frameworks. When you hit a dialectical roadblock, a deadlock, it's often not because the other person made a bad inference. It's because they're operating with a fundamentally different conceptual toolkit.
And if you can't even agree on the tools, you're just talking past each other. I'm thinking of Joseph Raz, who argued that philosophical orthodoxy can win out not because it's better, but just because it blunts your ability to even understand a rival view.
It ceases to be intellectually legible. If the only way you can make your case is by reaffirming the very conceptual links your opponent rejects, you aren't arguing. You're just restating. You're trapped.
So the only solution, the book claims, is to step back.
To the metaconceptual level, we have to find independent reasons, reasons that live outside the concepts themselves for why we should embrace them or, you know, get rid of them.
So if the concept itself is the cage, then metaconceptual reasoning is the key to the lock. And our mission today is to figure out which key to use.
To understand that, we have to deepen this distinction we just made between the two orders of reasoning.
Okay, let's start with the familiar. First order reasons. These are everyday, ordinary reasons for belief or for action, right?
Right. You see a red traffic light. That observation gives you a first order reason to stop your car. It's a reason the concept of, say, traffic law points you toward.
Simple enough. So what about second order reasons?
Now, this is the critical distinction. Second order reasons aren't about justifying one specific application of a concept. They're about justifying the use of the concept itself. A good second-order reason vindicates our overall confidence in that concept.
So if I use the concept of justice, my first-order reasons explain why a specific law is just. But second-order reasons would explain why I should even cultivate the disposition to treat the concept of justice as a source of first-order reasons to begin with.
Exactly. It's the search for reasons for our reasons. And that is precisely why the old foundationalist view, the idea that concepts just need to map onto some pre-existing world structure, starts to look, well, a little problematic.
You're talking about figures like Ted Sider, who focus on concepts in fundamental physics, the argument that the best concepts are the ones that, you know, carve nature at its joints.
Yes. But the book argues that appraising concepts only by whether they match an antecedently given world overlooks their core function, especially when we move outside of science and into human affairs.
Because a concept's merit depends not just on what it points to,
but on what follows from its correct application.
That's a fantastic way to put it. Concepts are consequential in the most literal sense.
Yeah.
You could have two concepts, X and Y, that pick out the exact same set of things in the world.
Right.
But if using concept X leads you to infer that you have duty A, and using concept Y leads you to infer you have duty B, then those concepts have radically different values.
And that functional difference is everything. It shifts the entire focus onto the inferential role of concepts,
yeah,
which, you know, aligns very nicely with what are called dual content theories in metasemantics.
Okay, let's pause there. Dual content. Can you unpack that phrase for us? What does that mean in practice?
Of course. So dual content theory suggests concepts have two kinds of content. First, there's referential content, which determines their extension, what they point to out in the world.
What they refer to.
And second, there's inferential content, which determines how they're classified, what other concepts they link up with, and crucially, what consequences follow from applying them. The key assumption is that the concepts we have systematically co-vary with the inferences we're disposed to make.
So concepts are, at their core, reasoning devices.
They're like specialized mindware or cultural software. They shape our thought from the inside out, which makes them prime movers for framing.
Absolutely. The work on framing effects by Bermudez is super relevant here. The concepts you have available to you really do help predetermine the judgments you reach.
And the specific reasons you take yourself to have. The book's classic example is Agamemnon's choice to sacrifice his daughter, Iphigenia.
Right. If you frame that action using the concept of pious obedience to the gods, you're immediately steered toward seeing it as justified.
But if you frame that very same action as shedding virgin's blood, you are steered directly toward condemnation. The concept isn't a neutral label. It's a filter that determines which reasons are even relevant.
It's a moral lens. And this effect is just amplified massively when we start dealing with thick normative concepts.
Yes. Think about words like chivalrous, sinful, corrupt, or honorable.
Those concepts are so powerful because they seem to fuse an observation directly with an implication.
They are complete codes of conduct. They link a set of empirical observations, which can be very hard to argue with, to these non-negotiable normative implications that are just baked right into the concept itself. This is the mechanism that leads to what Iris Murdoch called the siege of the individual by concepts.
A siege of the individual. That's powerful. Because if a thick concept applies, the normative consequence just follows, and you, the user, feel rationally compelled. If you hold a certain concept of legitimacy and a government meets all the criteria,
then you're left with, as the phrase goes, nothing else to think but that the government is legitimate, regardless of how you might feel about it.
And that's why the authority question is so urgent for these thick concepts. The social worlds we live in are contested, so asking which ethical or political concepts we should use is, in a very real sense, asking what kind of social world we want to inhabit.
Exactly. We have more freedom to choose these concepts than we do basic descriptive ones, and yet these are the concepts that do so much more to predetermine the run of our lives.
So the greater the power of the concept to bind us, the greater the need for a second-order justification for letting it bind us at all.
If concepts really do lock us into a framework, as we've been saying, if they are a form of conceptual confinement, then critiquing them becomes a massive philosophical challenge. How do you criticize the very space you inhabit?
You'd need to understand the concept from the inside to really grasp its normative pull.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, achieve enough critical distance to assess it from the outside.
Yeah.
That sounds like a kind of intellectual schizophrenia.
It requires a certain discipline. And the book formalizes this through a distinction between two modes of use, engaged versus disengaged.
So engaged use would be our default mode.
Mm-hmm.
You're fully absorbed in the concept. We're responsive to the reasons it points to.
Exactly. When I use the word justice in an engaged way, the reasons it provides claim universal validity. I think this is a reason to do X, not this is a reason for me, given my framework, to do X.
But for metaconceptual work, we need to enter disengaged use. We have to adopt what the book calls the autoethnographic stance.
Autoethnography is studying your own culture, your own framework, as if from a distance.
So we view our own concepts against a backdrop of possible alternatives.
Mm.
We have to temporarily suspend our normal emotional and rational responsiveness to them.
Right. We can still see what the world looks like to someone who lives by that concept, but we suspend the reasons it imposes on us. We don't discard it. We just hold it at arm's length.
Now, that sounds incredibly hard to do for everything at once. I assume you can't step back from all your concepts simultaneously. You'd have nothing left to think with.
You're right. It has to be piecemeal. But here's the major philosophical trap, conflating the two perspectives.
This is the danger of what you call the self-index truth.
Yes. When a philosopher realizes, from the disengaged perspective, that their reasons depend on the concepts they use, they often get tempted to reinsert that dependence back into the content of the engaged thought.
So they transform an engaged truth, like X is F, into a self-index truth. It is true in our conceptual scheme, S, that X is F.
And that fundamentally distorts the original claim. The whole point of engaged thought is that the reason appears to be simply there, universally applicable. By self-indexing it, you corrupt its meaning.
So the trick is to grasp the conceptual dependence of our reasons from the disengaged perspective without poisoning the well of the engaged thought itself.
Correct. This brings us right to Bernard Williams' challenge about confidence, contingency, and knowledge. Let's start with confidence.
Okay, confidence.
Confidence is the key psychological mechanism that sustains our engaged use of a concept. It's our degree of attachment, and it shows up in our readiness to respond to the first-order reasons the concept gives us. And crucially, confidence is what responds to our second-order reasons.
And what shakes that confidence is a sense of contingency. And we're not just talking about causal contingency, the historical accident that we happen to have these concepts.
No, we're focusing on rational contingency. This feeling arises when we're confronted with a real or even just a notional conceptual alternative, and we realize we have a perceived lack of independent reasons to prefer our own concepts.
We can't find a neutral argument to justify our choice, and that induces doubt in the rational necessity of our concepts. We feel arbitrary.
And that feeling of arbitrariness leads to Williams's famous skeptical conclusion that reflection destroys knowledge.
How does that destruction actually work? It's not that our judgments become false, right?
No, the truth values under the concepts might stay the same. But realizing their rational contingency can bar the user from engaged use. They can no longer fully identify with the concept.
So they lose the ability to know what can be known under those concepts.
Precisely. The internal voice of the concept, which used to speak with authority, now speaks with a kind of qualifier. While this is true, if you accept this arbitrary framework, it's a profound epistemic loss.
You can still recognize how the concept works, but you lose its binding normative force.
The book uses the powerful example of Oscar Wilde's trial. He was accused of blasphemy, but he refused to use the word blasphemous to describe his own work.
Even though he almost certainly knew that by the prevailing definition of the day, his story met all the conditions for being called blasphemous.
Of course, but he was making a completely disengaged use of the term. He was a figurehead of aestheticism. He acknowledged that his work might fit the description, but he utterly rejected the concept's claim to have any authority over his thought.
He was basically saying, "I see the rules of your game, and I refuse to play." He insisted on judging art only in aesthetic terms. Badly written, maybe, but never sinful or blasphemous.
Exactly. His loss of confidence in the concept blasphemous meant he could no longer use it to articulate ethical knowledge in that domain. That inability to know what others claim to know is the epistemic loss Williams was talking about.
This all leads to this very specific idea of the relativism of distance.
Yes, a defensive form of relativism Williams was interested in. It suggests that when we're faced with conceptual alternatives that are very far removed from our practical concerns, notional confrontations, we don't actually need to make substantive judgments about them.
It gives us the space for metaconceptual reflection without forcing us to take a definitive moral stance on, say, the practices of a historical culture.
Right. But the book pushes back against Williams's overall skepticism. It argues that reflection doesn't only destroy knowledge. It can actually strengthen confidence by yielding metaconceptual knowledge.
So realizing that our concepts are contingent doesn't have to lead to paralysis.
Not at all. Metaconceptual knowledge is the knowledge that the concepts in question are the right ones for us, even if they aren't the absolutely and definitively best concepts according to some timeless foundationalist dream.
And we get that knowledge by grounding the concept's authority in our needs, in reasons that are independent of the concept's own internal logic.
And that vindication turns the autoethnographic stance from a tool that only dissolves confidence into one that can actually strengthen it.
That goal-gaining metaconceptual knowledge is precisely what the book argues previous generations of thinkers failed to achieve. It outlines this kind of intellectual trap, a trilemma between foundationalism, ironism, and a kind of holism.
Let's start with foundationalism. This is the big one. The project of seeking timeless, mind-independent, rational foundations for our concepts.
The idea that concepts should reflect the metaphysically privileged structure of reality. We're back to carving at the joints.
And in basic science, this is very plausible. A concept in physics that aligns with a fundamental natural kind seems inherently better.
But the critique is that this project just collapses when you try to generalize it to thick normative concepts. Is there a timelessly privileged structure for chivalry or justice?
It seems highly unlikely. And this points to the idea that the plausibility of foundationalism is itself conditioned by contingent circumstances. As Wittgenstein might say, the primacy of practice is key.
Which leads us to the second horn of the trilemma, ironism.
The ironist, thinking of someone like Rorty, dismisses all human concepts as equally falsifying or arbitrary.
And the book has this fantastic psychological insight here, calling it disappointed foundationalism.
It's a crucial point. The ironist still fundamentally believes that conceptual authority must come from timeless foundations. When they look around and see that those foundations don't exist for our normative concepts, they don't discard the impossible standard.
They just conclude that all human concepts fail to meet it and are therefore equally meaningless.
The ironist is a counterfactual foundationalist, stuck in a state of perpetual disengagement, refusing to commit to any concept because they know none of them can achieve that impossible absolute grounding.
It's an indiscriminate critique that fails to see that, you know, some concepts are just demonstrably better than others for specific human purposes.
Right. So if foundationalism sets the bar too high and ironism gives up in disappointment, what about holistic non-foundationalism?
This view accepts that standards aren't universal. Hugh Price has that analogy of choosing the weave pattern for a fishing net.
It's a great analogy. It doesn't matter exactly which pattern you choose, so long as the net is functional and holds fish.
That seems pretty appealing. It avoids the rigidity of foundationalism.
It does, but its major problem is that it licenses the undiscriminating acceptance of inherited concepts. It fails to provide any positive reasons to prefer one conceptual framework over another within the range of usable ones. It just says the choice is arbitrary, so just keep using the one you have.
So it doesn't give us the critical leverage we need. It just deflates the worry about rational contingency by saying it's all arbitrary, so who cares? It doesn't solve the problem. It just ignores it.
So we have a trilemma, a rigid foundationalism, a cynical ironism, and a complacent holism.
To escape this, the book proposes we replace that old holistic picture, the idea that our conceptual apparatus is this harmonious, static thing, with what it calls the kaleidoscopic picture.
I love that term. The kaleidoscopic picture emphasizes tension and dynamism. It sees our existing conceptual toolkit as inherently tension-ridden. We don't need external timeless foundations to criticize it because the critique is already built in.
So if my ethical concepts conflict with my political concepts in some area, that internal conflict is itself a reason-driven engine for conceptual change.
Exactly. We gain critical distance not by trying to step outside of ourselves entirely, but by noticing the cracks and conflicts within our own conceptual structure.
Okay, so once we accept our concepts are dynamic and full of tension, the next impulse, especially for a philosopher, is to try and clean it all up, to impose order.
Which brings us to the tidy-minded ideal.
This is the ideal that seeks conceptual authority by modeling our concepts on those of good scientific theory. The goal is to eliminate vices like vagueness and inconsistency and maximize virtues like clarity and precision. It's a drive for systematic purity.
And the book argues fiercely against generalizing this demand as a universal source of authority. Theoretical virtues are only virtues in certain contexts. Outside of those, they can actually undermine a concept's value.
Let's start with inconsistency and paradox. Philosophers like Kevin Sharp argue that many of our core concepts, truth, justice, knowledge, are logically inconsistent.
In a formal system, inconsistency is fatal. But the book asks, why should the everyday concepts we live by have to adhere to that standard? Sometimes eliminating those internal tensions would require us to overturn deeply held judgments that have significant ethical force.
So if my concept of responsibility clashes with my concept of fairness in a particular case, I shouldn't necessarily resolve that by creating one single consistent theoretical construct.
The authors would say no. We need to be shown why the reasons from a perfectly tidy theoretical structure should have more authority than the reasons we get from our messy, unreconstructed concepts. Sometimes the tension itself is what best serves our human concerns.
Okay, what about depth? In science, depth, you know, attention to causal detail and generality is clearly a virtue.
Of course. But pursuing depth everywhere risks what we could call Laplacian blindness. If our concepts get too deep, focused only on fundamental physical or neurological causes, we might lose sight of the higher level structures that are crucial to human life, the ethical, the political.
Sometimes a more superficial level of description is what's actually needed to capture human significance.
Exactly. Which brings us to the most counterintuitive claim, the defense of the virtue of vagueness.
In philosophy, vagueness is almost always seen as a failure, a sign of sloppy thinking.
But the book makes a really strong case that vagueness and indeterminacy can be conceptual virtues in certain contexts, especially in politics. Think about building a coalition.
Right. If a political concept is too precise, it risks excluding potential allies who agree on the general grievance but disagree on the exact definition.
Precisely. Vague concepts can help build broad political coalitions. And they can also maintain a fragile peace by fudging incendiary issues that, if you force them into clarity, would just cause open conflict. In these domains, clarity is a political danger, and vagueness is a necessary social lubricant.
This leads to that really serious political critique, citing thinkers like Marcuse and Orwell, that tidy-mindedness can lead to a repressive reduction of thought.
I think this is a critical insight for anyone listening. If you take a vague, broad complaint about, say, systemic injustice, and an administrator transposes it into a precise, defanged description,
reducing a huge socioeconomic problem to a localized complaint about one specific workplace violation,
the radical critique gets neutralized. The focus shifts from the systemic failure that the vague concept was targeting to a minor, concrete problem that can be fixed within the status quo. You assimilate the critique by forcing it into a tidy box.
Which brings us back to the ultimate arbiter here. Prioritizing confidence over theory, the big ethical systems, Kantianism, utilitarianism, they all aim to tidy up our ethical thought.
They assume they have the authority to override our messy pre-theoretical judgments.
Yeah.
But as Williams pointed out, we aren't living our lives to exemplify a theory. Our immediate solidarity with people, our gut feelings on thick ethical issues, are often more robustly grounded in our experience than any abstract system.
So the burden of proof is on the systematizers. They have to show why their tidy structure should be granted more authority than our existing messy distribution of confidence.
The simple fact that it's theoretically virtuous is not enough to grant it conceptual authority.
So we've worked through the major contenders and found them lacking. Timeless foundationalism, cynical ironism, complacent holism, and now the universal tyranny of tidy-mindedness. What's left is the book's core positive contribution, the needs-based approach.
The standard here is entirely pragmatic, but it's not arbitrary. The value of a concept lies in the way it proves to be of value to us by meeting our conceptual needs. And these needs provide the second-order reasons we've been looking for.
Now, we have to be very careful to distinguish conceptual needs from simple purposes or goals.
Absolutely. Goals are things we consciously pursue. Needs are deeper. They're often opaque reflections of our core concerns, what we fundamentally care about, refracted through our specific, limited human capacities and our circumstances. Discovering our conceptual needs can be a genuine discovery.
Okay, so this leads to the formal definition, the need matrix framework.
Right. A group of conceptual users has a conceptual need for a concept F, and only if the use of F is especially conducive to satisfying a concern C that the users critically identify with.
And that phrase, critically identifies with, is doing a lot of ethical work there.
It is. It rules out concerns that are based on misinformation or coercion. It has to be a concern the user endorses after a well-informed reflection.
And these concerns, combined with our capacities and circumstances, generate what are called pro-tanto conceptual needs.
Yes. And since our concerns often conflict, we end up with multiple pro-tanto needs, which then have to be balanced to figure out, are all things considered conceptual need?
Let's make this concrete with the honor need matrix example. This is a brilliant way to show how the reasons for a concept's value can be totally external to its content.
The honor example is perfect. The instrumental need for a concept of honor arises from a specific matrix of conditions. First, a concern. Individuals want to hold onto their property.
Okay.
Second, a capacity. They have a limited personal ability to prevent theft. And third, a circumstance. Centralized institutions like police or courts are weak or non-existent.
So you need a concept that creates a decentralized deterrent. A code of honor makes it so that individuals are socially required to retaliate for even small infractions, which makes everyone think twice before transgressing.
And the crucial insight is that the content of the concept honor doesn't actually mention weak institutions or property rights. It only works because its needfulness is derived from those external conditions.
And that gives us critical force today. We can look back at an honor culture and see why it was rational for them to use that concept. But because our circumstances have changed, we have police and courts, we can confidently say we no longer need it.
The concept has outlived the conditions that gave it value. This is how the needs-based approach achieves metaconceptual knowledge without falling back on foundationalism.
But let's hit the big objection. The wrong kind of reasons worry. If a concept is good because it's useful for our concerns, doesn't that instrumentalize everything, even a core value like truth?
This is where the book introduces the principle of instrumentality without instrumentalizing mentality. It's a subtle but crucial move.
Okay, so take the concept of truth. We absolutely treat truth as intrinsically valuable. If the needs-based approach says we value it because it serves our concern for pooling information, doesn't that make truth merely instrumental?
That's the worry. If I only value truth when it helps me, I'm its terrible epistemic partner. The whole system would collapse.
So how does the framework handle this?
It argues that the concept of truth needs to be regarded as intrinsically valuable in order to function instrumentally for us. If everyone only valued truth when it was convenient, our entire system of shared knowledge would fall apart due to free riding and distrust.
So truth must be valued for its own sake in order to best serve our concerns about information pooling. Its value has to feel transcendent for it to be instrumentally valuable to us.
Precisely. This shows that a concept can serve our concerns best by screening out any thought about how its use relates to those concerns. You don't think, I'll say this is true because it helps my concern C. You just think, X is true. The authority is secured metaconceptually by the need matrix, but the engaged use must remain blind to that matrix.
Okay, let's put this framework into action. Let's start with the concept of the voluntary and that tension between depth and functionality.
The concept of the voluntary is absolutely central to accountability. So the needs-based approach asks, what concerns drive our need for this distinction? And the main ones are holding people accountable while also maintaining concerns for fairness.
And the typical philosophical impulse, the tidy-minded impulse, is to seek a deepened conception of the voluntary. We want to define it as pure, unconditioned action, free from all contingency.
But if we deepen the concept that much, it becomes useless. All human actions are mired in contingency, luck, genetics, environment. A concept of pure voluntary action would have a nearly empty extension in the real world.
So even though that pure concept might perfectly express our concern for absolute fairness, it can't actually serve that concern in any practical way.
It becomes unusable. Therefore, the concept we actually need must be superficial and gradable. It has to draw a distinction within the range of conditioned actions, not between conditioned and unconditioned ones. It has to be luck tolerant.
So superficiality, which we normally think of as a vice, becomes a necessary conceptual virtue here.
It does. A functional concept of the voluntary has to make us sensitive to the degree to which an action is attributable to an agent's will, which realistically serves our concerns for accountability.
Okay, our second case study, liberty in a pluralistic democracy. This ties back to that Dworkin-Williams debate. Dworkin wants a tidy, integrated framework. Williams is skeptical. Grounded in value pluralism.
Right. And if we accept that value pluralism is a defining feature of modern life that values conflict not just between people but within the breast of each individual, then the conceptual needs for a political concept of liberty get very complex.
So the concept has to be elastic enough to meet the needs of both the winners and the losers of a political decision. Let's start with the losing side's needs.
Okay, so the losing side of a legitimate political decision, their legal rights haven't been infringed. According to Dworkin's idea of rightful freedom, they have no complaint.
But they still need a concept of liberty that's broader than that. They need to be able to voice a reasonable complaint in liberty, to articulate a genuine loss and a reasonable resentment.
Otherwise, they're just dismissed as being confused about their own rights. And this directly serves the needs of the winning side as well.
How so? The winner's need isn't for complaint. It's for social cohesion.
Exactly. The winning side needs a concept of liberty that allows for respect across the aisle. It needs to equip them to acknowledge the real costs in liberty that their opponents have incurred. They need to be able to see the opponent's resentment as reasonable, even if they disagree with it.
Wow. So the concept of liberty needs to be messy and tension-ridden, because the society it governs is messy and tension-ridden. Pluralism itself creates a shared, second-order need for a more flexible, accommodating concept.
That's the key takeaway. It shows how conceptual needs can arise directly from the tension between our fundamental human concerns.
This brings us full circle, though, to the proper place of tidiness. We said generalizing the tidy-minded ideal is a mistake, but surely there are some places that still demand it.
Oh, absolutely. The need for principled, systematic, and consistent concepts is legitimate, where accountability is paramount in public discourse, in administrative functions, in the law.
Modern societies need public agencies to be answerable to a pluralistic public, and that requires a retreat to thinner, more systematic concepts that are easier to justify and aggregate.
But, and this is a big but, this necessary tidiness comes with a major risk: value capture. This is the idea that the simplified, aggregable, thin concepts needed for public administration can displace and eventually override the richer, thicker concepts we need for a substantive, personal, ethical life.
So if the public administrative concept of success is reduced to a quantifiable metric, like revenue, and that standard creeps into my private life, I risk losing my messier, thick concept of a good life or meaningful work.
The public need for tidiness becomes a kind of private tyranny. The book warns that we have to be vigilant about this trade-off, constantly asking if the concepts we use for public necessity are encroaching on the domain of our private, thick, ethical lives, where messiness is a virtue.
This deep dive has been, well, expansive. To try and synthesize the core conclusion, conceptual authority stems from alignment with our conceptual needs. That triad of critically identified concerns, our limited capacities, and our specific circumstances.
And that view is profoundly liberating. It frees us from the tyranny of needing universal, timeless foundations to justify our mental lives. It offers a justification that is contingent, yes, but not arbitrary.
It lets us see that while our conceptual repertoire is causally contingent, a product of history, the fact that the needs it must meet are also contingent dispels that feeling of rational contingency.
The question changes. It's no longer why these arbitrary concepts, it's why these concepts, given who we are, where we are, and what we critically care about. And that replaces a feeling of arbitrariness with a sense of necessity.
And the ultimate application of this is in how we handle disagreement. If we can transpose a diffuse epistemological disagreement, they are just wrong, into a focused ethical disagreement about conceptual needs, we can facilitate a much more respectful disagreement.
We can adopt that autoethnographic stance toward our opponent's concepts and genuinely understand why it makes sense for them to use those concepts given their needs. They aren't just confused, they have reasons for reasoning as they do.
Which leaves us with our final provocative thought. If this needs-based approach allows us to criticize others' concepts by faulting their objectionable concerns, say, we fault the concept of honor because it's based on a concern for social dominance, doesn't this ultimate reliance on our own critically identified concerns still leave us with a self-referential standard?
It does. The authority of our critique ultimately rests on the license we've gained to continue using our own concepts in a confident, engaged way. So the reflective philosopher has to ask, does this reliance on our own internal ethical compass offer sufficient grounding in a radically pluralistic world? Or does the ghost of that universal timeless standard still haunt the periphery of our ethics? That's the critical question this book demands you to explore next.